may assist as a producer on those things you commit it or not, it takes effect in the same.
Yeah, it will, because we said we were entertaining this submission on the basis of seeking to understand the import of the submission, not to discuss them, because we delayed discussion of them. Maybe that's why the opinions that were raised were not necessarily captured, but I take it your point is noted, because those comments may lead to a decision being taken one way or the other. Page 7. Page 8. Okay, that then brings us to. Who wants to move the adoption of the minutes as a correct reflection of what transpired?
Do you suspect anything, maybe that's the reason why she does not want to go to it? Anything other than what you told
us? I really don't know. We did ask her, why are you not coming to work? She just shook her shoulders. As if it's a non-care. She wasn't there. She didn't get paid. It's from March already, March this year. But no remuneration. That she has invested. And she's living on those investments.
And then her condition?
Her condition looks fine. She was driving a car. She's still driving it in the seat. And we explained to her that the seriousness of this matter, except for giving her a copy of our letter of the 5th of December, as well as referring to our previous visit at the service residence, as well as the seriousness of the contents of the letter which we served on her in Parliament's consideration to have her removed from office. Yeah, I don't know. I asked her, what do you plan to do? Why didn't you come to the office? She said, I don't know what to do. But we told her, you would just get back to the office or just phone us, get help. But she says she's not prepared to go back to the maintenance office at Wainford.
Chairperson. If there is an evidence that the letter has been served to her personally, and then she didn't respond, I'm sure there is a clause which gives now the order, if a person doesn't respond at a certain stage, will be tantamount to her own dismissal. It's so easy. What says the law about that?
Chair, my thinking is that in the last meeting, when we requested the commission to visit her and ask her to give the evidence so that we have some information as to how we deal with it, but we also took a decision in that meeting that if she does not respond or do anything else. In terms of that meeting and what we hear today, it means she has absconded, she has relieved herself of those duties. Now, we don't have to revisit this particular point. Our position in terms of those particular minutes is a decision has been taken in that meeting. But if she does not respond, we don't even have to come back and resolve on this particular matter, because it was resolved in that meeting. And that is my view. The only area that I think will be important for us is if this evidence, because if she has signed that she has accepted that particular letter and she did not respond, in terms of that meeting, then she's no longer part of the institution. Thanks, Chair.
I think we don't have to waste time. Mm. We resolved on the issue, and she did not respond accordingly, and that decision stays. Can we get the report on the case of Ms.
you, Mr. Chair. At the previous meeting, you will recall that on this matter, the committee was advised that the minister was in the process of considering the upliftment of Ms. Bachram's suspension. The minister has, in the meantime, uplifted the suspension on 16 September 2009 and filed a report in this regard. Ms. Bachram has reported for duty on 5 October this year. The purpose of this report was to inform Parliament of the minister's decision. It's just proposed that the committee can take note thereof.
Anything
you want to say? No, Chair. I think we just take a note. We are happy with the process.
Thank you very much. Can we get the briefing and the suspension, provisional suspension of Ms. Ndamase and Mr. Dumane?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll start with Ms. Ndamase. He's an additional magistrate at Pretoria. She's been a prosecutor at Pretoria before being appointed at the district court bench. She was appointed in July 1999 as a magistrate, so she's been there for 10 years now. Mr. Nair, the chief magistrate of Pretoria, filed complaints with the commission against her at its meeting held on the 4th of December. The ethics committee of the commission gave Mr. Nair the opportunity to orally brief the committee on the content of a statement he made, an affidavit, in which he fully set out the complaints. Now, you deal with a lot of complaints, Chairperson. First of all, there is, in his opinion...
Sorry for a moment, I don't remember.
Chair, it would have been good if, when we are briefed on this particular matter, we also have copies of their own report. Because, you know, for us to... the difficulty we're going to be faced with is already an indication that there are a lot of matters. How do we deal with if we don't have a report in front of us?
Will you be able to make copies?
Okay, I can make copies. The problem was the white table. The participants were not able to get enough people to say what is the problem. So I do apologize for that, but I can make four copies now.
Can we adjourn for a moment so that the mission will come to the
suspension of Ms. Marcy. I gave you a bit of background. Paragraph 2 of the report found by the minister. Ms. Marcy is an addition magistrate at Pretoria District Court. She's been prosecuted at Pretoria before being appointed to the District Court bench. She was appointed in July 1999 as a magistrate. And Mr. Nair, the chief magistrate of Pretoria, filed complaints with the commission against both the two additional magistrates, Ms. Mafafu and Ms. Marcy. Mufafu resigned shortly thereafter. So we have no jurisdiction over Mrs. Mufafu again anymore, and we proceeded with the matter of Mrs. Damasi. Now, Chair, on page 2.2, with regard to the conduct of Mrs. Damasi, Mr. Neer, the Chief Magistrate, is of the opinion that steps be taken against her for insubordination and indolent or negligent execution of duties. He alleged that her conduct is contrary to the code of conduct for magistrate and the unbecoming judicial officer. She was on her own request rotated from the criminal to the civil section in Pretoria prior to Mr. Neer's appointment as Chief Magistrate in Pretoria. On the 15th of January 2007, according to an affidavit filed by Mrs. Rademan, the senior magistrate in control of the civil section in Pretoria, Mrs. Ndamase did her full civil training at Business College and attended various courses. Magistrate Nyambu was appointed as a tutor for a period of 3 months, and they both tried their best with her training. Then it is alleged that Mrs. Ndamase seldom grants default judgments and that she is sending them back with a lot of unfound queries. When attorneys attempt to address these queries with her in chambers, an audience is summarily refused. Correspondence directed to her by attorneys in this regard is left unanswered. In an effort to assist, Mr. Rademan wrote Mrs. Ndamase a letter on the 29th of May 2008, wherein she kindly requested Mrs. Ndamase to look into a few matters. She concluded her expert training. I hope you find it helpful. If you have any other problems, feel free to discuss it with me. Mrs. Ndamase responded by stating explicitly and in no uncertain terms that she doesn't want Mrs. Rademan's training. Mrs. Miyambu, in her statement dated the 3rd of December 2008, indicates that civil trials allocated to Mrs. Ndamase would be returned after the civil order has been called, with either postponement or settlement. She mentions that trial matters are not the only cases that have been problematic. Mrs. Ndamase has been requested in the past to deal with ex parte matters. On numerous occasions, she would refer ex parte applications to me, that's to Mrs. Miyambu, on the grounds that the papers were in Afrikaans or that she didn't understand the rule or act applicable to the application. At a certain point, she refused to assist and refer the matter back to Mrs. Ndamase. And the other matters in the civil section had to deal with the trials that were allocated to her. Mr. Neer states further that Mrs. Ndamase conducting herself in an insubordinate manner. She inter alia refused to go to his office when requested to do so on the 1st of December. She further refused to attend a meeting on the 2nd of December without a legal representative being present. And this is just within the normal office environment. When requested to attend to inquest, Ms. Ndamase indicated to Ms. Rademan that she refuses to work under Mr. Rapashlele, the senior magistrate quasi-judicial matters at Pretoria, or Mrs. Mamasebo, the senior magistrate heading the criminal section. When Mr. Ndamase, after a short absence, returned to the civil section, she indicated to Ms. Rademan that she is no longer able to do ex parte applications and or any matter where the National Credit Act is applicable. She indicated that her handbooks were at Attridgeville. She was just leaving at Attridgeville. She left the handbooks there and that she was therefore unable to do civil work. She was then referred to one of her colleagues to use her textbook, but responded that her office was too far away. It's on the same premises. The result is that the other magistrates in the civil section had to deal with this application. And she was placed in a section 65 court to enable her to be slowly integrated back into the civil section again. She objected to it, stating that she regards the section 65 court as an inferior court. On the 29th of May 2008, Ms. Rademan, in a letter to the chief magistrate, reported that she is still prepared to do her utmost to give Ms. and the master the necessary training, but for the training to be successful, she will have to change her attitude. Willing to accept training and guidance and not to regard it as persecution and placing pressure on the supervisors. Mrs. Rademan, in a further statement dated the 3rd of February this year, is of the view that Mrs. Ndamase is not competent to do civil work, despite the fact that she received extensive training from Justice College. Numerous times she refused to do the work allocated to her without any valid reason. Now, having been briefed by Mr. Neer, the Ethics Committee at its meeting held on the 4th of December resolved that Mrs. Ndamase be charged with misconduct in terms of Regulation 26.1, and the Commission is empowered to do so without conducting a preliminary investigation. The Committee is of the view that there is prima facie evidence to support charges of misconduct. And the Ethics Division recommended this to the full Commission, and the full commission at its meeting held on the 29th and the 30th of May resolved to recommend to Parliament that she be provisionally suspended pending an investigation into her fitness to hold office. She was requested to show cause why such a decision should not be taken, and then she requested the Ethics Committee to recuse itself without any valid reason. She was again given the opportunity to respond, and in her response she just says that she thinks that the commission is acting prematurely, and that and finds it inappropriate not to recuse itself. Well, Chairperson, she also filed criminal charges of perjury against the head of office, which is Mayor Pretoria, which the DPP declined to prosecute. But the situation, Mr. Neb reports that the situation is serious. She does what she pleases. She leaves the office without permission. She refuses to perform criminal work allocated to her. So it's really, he said, it is to such an extent that he cannot tolerate it anymore. She is really making a message and an embarrassment to the industry to have her in the office whilst the misconduct inquiry is to be held. So the commission recommends that she be provisionally suspended from office. She has not been charged with misconduct as yet. We are busy compiling a charge that will be served on her shortly, whereafter then we shall proceed with the misconduct inquiry.
If I may ask, how did this thing start? It just abruptly started, and then she started behaving in that particular manner. I understand the issue of that, you know, where she has been given a civil matter. She said the handbook is in Attridgeville, and thereafter she said, no, she can't use somebody's handbook. Was that thing investigated as to why she didn't want water? What is the relationship between Mr. Ney and her? How did this start? That is the problem. If we can be cleared there, this other thing will follow.
Chair, I think I want to align myself with the point raised by my colleague here. You know, it is important because the commission has not indicated to us as to, I know they're trying to charge a doing well, but they haven't investigated anything. You know, because they're not giving us as to what they did, because there might have been a problem between the two individuals prior to this particular process. And I clearly think it would be unfair to proceed with something given, you know, once you have one-sided story and you start prosecuting whatever, because when this matter came to you, you should have investigated first before you start other processes. Because there might be a relations problem between individuals. You might not know, you see. And also, she's working with a number of other colleagues. You know, commission could have found out from the other colleagues as to what the situation is, so that you don't have a one-sided story. You know, because what we're trying to get here is clearly a one-sided story, which does not, you know, argue very well with the entire process. And I think it would be premature for us, you know, to take a decision whilst we don't have, you know, as this particular committee. Maybe it would be important to share that possibly if we don't summon both, but, you know, if they are going to be charged, then there's something we can't summon them here, you know, so that we get both stories as to what is happening. Or we do some oversight towards the Magistrates Court in Pretoria and check as to what the situation is. Because we might get something different when we get there, and the commission is fed with a lot of with another story, you know. And the reality of the matter is, what is placed before the commission, you know, they will take that. That is the reality of the matter, you know, because they don't have the other side of what is happening, what is exactly happening in that particular institution. Maybe it will be for this committee to provide an oversight in that particular area and find out what is happening there. Because we might be thinking of this particular matter, and there might be a lot of other situations in that institution. Thank you, Chair.
How do you respond?
Chair, what is actually not before you is a lot of correspondence in this file, which was attached to Mr. Nez S. David. And this is included in that is correspondence between the head of office, Mr. Nair, and Mrs. Sindamati, as well as Mrs. Rademan, Mrs. Mamasebo, Ms. Miambu. They made several statements and correspondence to and from Mrs. Sindamati is also attached. And on the basis of that, the commission recommended that she be charged with misconduct. If you can just read one letter dated the 2nd of February this year, addressed from addressed to Mr. Nair from Mrs. Sindamati. She says, first of all, I have to make you aware that Section 12.1 of the Magistrates Court Act does not give you the latitude of imposing yourself in any fashion you like upon any magistrate in this establishment. It may be allowing a magistrate to be subject to the administrative control of the head of the administrative region in which he is her district is situated, but unfortunately for you, it doesn't allow you to have any matters under your control and thereby make employment of such person intolerable. When you read any provision of the Act, please learn not to read it in isolation. There is a lot of correspondence in which the tone of her letters, and there is a relation problem maybe with her coming to Mr. Nair's office. She filed a grievance only after these complaints had been filed with the commission. So Mr. Nair filed a complaint against her first, and then she filed a grievance with the commission. Now, the commission resolved not to attend to the grievance as yet because there is still a misconduct trial pending. And this will be part of the evidence which will be led either on behalf of the commission or on behalf of herself. She says it's an unfortunate that I'm telling you that I'm not going to report to the criminal section at all. You have reported me to the Magistrates Commission and the decision to charge me has already been taken. Even before they charged me, you rushed and took a decision to suspend me. But that's not true. Chair, the particular magistrate charged, if a charge sheet is served on her, there is an invitation included for her to submit a written explanation to the commission. What is in dispute and what is admitted? What is in denial and what is admitted? Then only the inquiry starts. Then, of course, evidence will be led a court procedure. And she will have the opportunity to respond to that. She will have the opportunity to cross-examine each and every witness in that inquiry. Only after the inquiry, only after the deciding officer has made a finding, then she again will have the opportunity to make representations to the commission. The early ultimatum bottom rule will be applied to and complied with. But the situation is that in Pretoria or in each and every magistrate's office, the head of the office, the judicial head, the magistrate of that particular district, can allocate, like in the High Court, allocate a judge to say, today we do motion court, tomorrow you do civil work, next week or next month I'm going to allocate you criminal work. But it appears to me that there are problems with her competency in the civil section. Now, she was on her own request transferred to the criminal section to the civil section, and she wanted to apply to the regional court, and the regional court only does criminal work. But Mr. Nair didn't find it fit for her to go to the regional court because her work was not up to standard. So he then requested her to go back to the criminal court. Now, at one stage, she says, no, I'm fine. I spoke to Mr. Mamasebo and I'll go to the criminal court. But now she doesn't want to go to the criminal court. She only does some checking and of admissions of guilt at the moment.
Besides,
but it's a difficult situation, Chair.
Besides the correspondence you received from Mr. Maye, did you interact maybe with Ms. Ndamas to try to find out on your own what the real problem is?
Chair, no, not at this stage. What she requested is all the information which the Ethics Committee had in front of it before taking the decision. She requested that information. She was submitted and furnished a copy of thereof, and then she was requested to respond and to show cause why the Commission should not suspend her from office. And then she said, now the committee is biased and that it has already been taken a decision to charge her with misconduct, and therefore they should recuse itself. But the committee found no reason to excuse itself, because who else from the Commission will deal with the matter?
Just from the letter that was sent to us now, it is very clear that there are serious problems in the relationship problems, and the Commission on its own did not in any way, even before whatever process that they wanted to undertake, to try and find out from the institution as to what are the problems in the institution. Because you see, we might be looking at this individual, and there might be serious problems in the institution itself. You see? I think broader so. And my view, Chair, is that once I understand that this might be a process, it might be a proper case. You see, we are not going to resolve the problems in the institution by charging individuals. You see, we are not going to resolve the problems we have there. You see? Therefore, it is important, Chair, that at this stage, that we do some investigation before this committee we recommend anything. We can't recommend anything else until we have proper information, you know, that will assist us to assist the Commission to move forward with whatever work that they are supposed to do. Because it is very clear, if just a letter that has been read to us tells you that there's a lot that has happened previously. That's what it tells you, you know. And unfortunately, both the Commission and ourselves don't have that information. The information is in that institution. Yeah. Both of us, seated here, we don't have that information. But it tells you there's a long history of problems and grievances that are there. You know, possibly from both people involved in this particular problem. We might not know what the real issue is. And my view, Chair, is we are not going to, this particular committee, recommend anything else on this particular matter until such time that we have proper information that can assist us to assist the Commission to move forward. And therefore, I'm just saying, therefore it becomes important for us as a committee to do some oversight or get information, do some oversight in that institution. You see, that will give us some more insight so that we know exactly as to how we deal with matters that come from that particular institution. Well, that letter tells you a lot. It tells you there are a lot of issues that you can deduce from the letter. That's the portion that has been read. We don't know of the other letters, what do they say. But just that one, there's a lot of information in as far as that letter is concerned. Thank you, Chair.
While aligning myself with my colleague, the main application here is the suspension. So, but you are applying for suspension. I think the requirement of a person to be suspended is one, if he or she is likely to interfere with the further investigation or the smooth running of the investigation. If none, do we have any tangible evidence that no, she's going to disrupt or to make the this trial unbearable? If none, why the application of suspension? Because she can still go on with the processes of the discipline without being suspended. Thanks, Chair.
How do you respond to... Before you respond, Honorable Matilda.
No, Chair. Maybe let him respond and I'll come later.
Yeah. Okay. I can just read from the report on page 5. The first paragraph, Mr. Mayor says he's no longer able to communicate sensibly with Mr. Damasi. Page 5 of the report. The fifth sentence. The fourth sentence, it says here, he is no longer able to communicate sensibly with Mr. Damasi. If Mr. Mayor calls her to the office, then she wants a legal representative to be attending as well. She doesn't accept letters. Okay. He reports that her conduct has reached a stage where it is causing a tremendous negative impact on the operation of the court and causing great embarrassment to the judiciary. And he requested the commission to take steps to have a suspended provision. And she is totally unapproachable and refuses to carry out any instructions. Chairperson, but we can do some more investigation if the committee resolves to do that. We'll do some more investigation, get some more information to this committee, because we need to draft a charge sheet as well. So we need to, but I can't foresee that we can speak to her at this stage. I mean, we are going to lead the evidence in this matter on behalf of the commission. I don't know whether it would be inappropriate for me to speak to the other side before a misconduct inquiry commences. But I won't have a problem speaking to her and getting the crux of the matter. What exactly is her problem?
Chair, I was just saying that was part of the recommendations we want to bring is for us to have some oversight. The fortunate part is I'm in Pretoria, and I'll be in the city centre. If arrangements can be made, if that is not going to affect the investigations or whatever, so I have some insight with both individuals. I can meet with her. I don't have a problem. If an arrangement can be made for Monday, because I'll be in the city centre. I'll go to, if she's at the regional court, I can go there, if somebody can just indicate this, how we meet. But I think it would be important, not for me as an individual, but for the committee to have an oversight there, But I won't have a problem, Chair, to give you feedback, having met with both individuals there, to indicate as to what the situation is. Fortunately, because Pretoria is my hometown, I might be able to know some other people in the vicinity to speak to and get some insight from those individuals waiting there as to what the situation is around the table.
So I think when I support the suggestion, it will definitely help us to go ahead after all this background.
I think we agree that you go on Monday and meet with them. And maybe we will check, because there was a proposal that the cooperative governors will be going to Gauteng on the 22nd or 23rd. I'm not certain about the date. Yes. Maybe during the visit to Gauteng, we'll split and others can go to Pretoria, but you can go on Monday on behalf of the committee. Can we resolve that Honorable Member Matila will go to Pretoria on Monday, and the committee will also go on the 22nd or 23rd, we'll be going to Gauteng. We'll also go to Pretoria, and in the meantime, you also do what you're supposed to do as a commission, and we will meet after that visit. We will send an invitation to you so that you come and brief the committee, and we also interact with you about our visit in Pretoria. Will that be fine with you?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it's a practical problem. Mr. Mayor is chairing one of the other misconduct inquiries, which is to be held in Kovranet and which commence on Monday. So he won't be at the office on Monday and Tuesday, and then on the appeal. Monday and Tuesday he won't be. But you can speak to the senior magistrates as well. But I can make an arrangement with the Honourable Member. And Mr. Sundamasi, of course, has already been suspended. The minister signs. As soon as the minister signs, then she's suspended from office. But surely we can get hold of her. We can make an arrangement.
Okay. Maybe, Chair, because I can get there in the afternoon of Monday. But in the morning, I'm attending to other issues that in the morning. But from after lunch, from, let's say, 2 o'clock, I'm spending an hour there. I don't have a problem. Yeah, he'll give you all my contact number so that we then indicate who I should meet there. If an arrangement can be made that I meet her there too on Monday, that will be fine.
Okay, can we then go to the report on Mr. Duma?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll proceed to that. The purpose of this document is to inform Parliament on the provisional suspension of Mr. Dumbani, Magistrate of Prof. Lift. Mr. Dumbani, he was appointed as judicial head of the District Court Tribunal. He was duly admitted as an attorney on the 15th of May, 1997. He was appointed as an acting magistrate by the Minister with effect from 1 November 2008. He is currently serving as an acting magistrate on for a probationary period of 12 months. The investigation instituted by the Commission confirmed that 4 complaints by 4 female employees employed at the Gauteng Courthouse were filed against Mr. Dumbani. It is alleged that Mr. Dumbani, during this period, December 2008, excuse me, got there, and January 2009, on different occasions, conducted himself in an unbecoming and embarrassing manner by stroking the cheek of a cleaner and the security officer with the back of his hand and tickling the back of the neck of the cleaner. He also stuck his hand between the clerk of the court's breast. Mr. Dumbani denies all these allegations. On 5 March 2009, the Executive Committee of the Magistrates Commission resolved to charge Mr. Dumbani with 4 counts of misconduct. Arrangements were made for the misconduct inquiry to commence. On 14 May 2009, due to technicalities, this could not materialize. The inquiry is now set down to commence. The evidence have already been led here. On 6 March 2009, the Commission asked Mr. Dumbani to show cause why decision to provisionally suspend him from duty, pending the outcome of an investigation into his fitness to hold office. Why that should not be taken. On 26 March 2009, his attorney acting on his behalf indicated that his client does not wish to make any representation to the Commission with regard to his provisional suspension. And then at its meeting held on 29 and 30 July 2009, the Commission considered the matter and resolved to advise him to provisionally suspend the Minister. Requested the committee to the from office in terms of Section 33A. The following considerations weighed with the Commission. The allegations against Mr. Dumbani are of such a serious nature as to make it inappropriate for him to perform these functions while the allegations are being investigated, and that should the allegations be proved true, he could be liable to be removed from office. And given the current public outcry against the abuse of women by men, Mr. Dumbani's continued service, on the bench would severely damage the image of the judiciary. His continued service may be construed as some indication of insensitivity. The judicial officers are expected to be explanatory in order to inspire confidence in the administration of justice. Although the accusations are thought to be proved, the sheer moral depravity of the allegations is such that Mr. Dumbani should be taken off the bench in the meantime. He has only recently been appointed as judicial head of office at the Gauteng Courthouse. The matter has received publicity in the media, and the alleged conduct was at the workplace involving junior staff members. The complainants had to receive counseling. They all experienced a tense working relationship and tried to avoid having to make contact with him whatsoever. It would be appropriate to keep Mr. Damani away from that office in the meantime. I can just maybe just add that because it's such a very big office, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if there's about seven women there, and I mean four of them are complainants. Actually, there were five, but the one is busy with the divorce, and she did not see it fit to, in her circumstances, to continue with the allegations brought against her. So we could only have four complainants came forward with statements. This is a part heard matter now. The state the misconduct inquiry. The evidence of the four complainants have already been led. There are two other witnesses that have to be led still. This is the situation as it is now.
It is a task of sexual harassment, not so. You can say yes or no, because I want to ask something.
Mr. Chair, we charge somebody with, it comes down to, in normal language, harassment, but we charge the person of the code of conduct not being complied with.
Yes, but the fact is it's a sexual harassment. What I want to ask, in most sexual harassment cases, there's one problem is the following. If the lady has already warned the particular person, if you go to a lady, then you do it, or sometimes you hug her, you bump her, something of the sort. She must definitely tell you that, no, you stop this thing. I don't want this thing. Firstly, so that you're aware, because sometimes it happened in a span of moments, then you find that they were friends, and this thing comes later, and that day she was not prepared to joke with you, then you come with such type of cases. We need this thing to be all right. If it is properly investigated, what was the relationship before this thing happened, and thereafter we can see all right what to do.
Mr. Chair, this is so. The Mr. Damani started at the office on 1 December, so he was newly appointed. There was no previous contact with these complainants. The first complainant was the incident occurred just about at the introduction. Another magistrate introduced Mr. Damani to the complainant. The other magistrate left the office, and he started stroking her cheek, and she said to him, please do not do that. And he just smiled at her, and then he said sorry. And then after a while, when she stood up, he again did it, and then she said to him, I told you not to do that ever again. And then she left the office. That is just one of the matters. So the lady, in no uncertain words, informed Mr. Damani that I am not available for your conduct, and I don't approve of it. And she said it quite loud to him.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, may I just add, this is exactly what the misconduct inquiry, the purpose of the misconduct inquiry is about. It's for the presiding officer to make a finding on the credibility of the witnesses. And these matters are also dealt with in cross-examination. All these complainants are extensively cross-examined on these matters. So it's for the presiding officer during the misconduct inquiry to make a ruling in that regard. We're just asking for the provisional suspension in the meantime, because at the office, it is quite, he's the heading of the office, he's the initial head of the office. They need to see him with found, the domestic matters, domestic violence matters. There is close contact between the clerks and the head of office, and it makes it a difficult situation. That's why we're asking for this provisional suspension of this particular matters.
Chair, without going further into this particular matter, I'm going to recommend that this committee grant the request from the commission.
Thank you, Chair.
Just on charity, on the previous case, you mentioned that Ms. Ndamase has already been suspended. When does the suspension become effective? When the minister has signed your recommendation, or when the committee has granted the approval?
Thank you, Chair. May I just respond by referring you to the Act. Section 13.3a of the United States Act says the minister on the advice of the commission may provision suspend the minister from office if the commission has afforded her or him an opportunity to respond and an investigation has been instituted and then a report in which the provisional suspension in terms of paragraph A of the matters of a magistrate and the reasons therefore are made known must be tabled in Parliament by the minister within 7 days of such suspension. So the minister suspends on the advance of the commission, the provision suspends, and it takes effect on the day that he signs and writes him or her a letter. The minister wrote a letter to Mrs. Ndamase, suspending her from office, and then it needs to be confirmed by Parliament. If Parliament does not confirm, of course, then she has to be reinstated.
I'm seconding his proposal because from the information given and the explanation, we really grant that the person be suspended.
Yeah. Chair, in terms of the first matter, we because the committee is not taking a decision on that first matter, we'll ask for it to stand down in line with what you have just indicated. So that when we come back with that information, we're able to take a decision as to whether we support the decision of the minister through the advice of the commission or whatever, because that will then give us an insight. So that we might be also able to advise the minister to indicate otherwise if we find the situation to be different. You see?
I think we agree with the committee that on the request of Ms. Ndamase, we will await the interaction by both the commission and the committee, and we will pronounce after that interaction. And then on the request on Magistrate Duman, the request is granted. Thank you very much. This then brings us to the end of the meeting. The meeting is adjourned. The commission.
To be excused, then, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you are.
Thank you.
And Honorable Matilda, you also requested.
Yeah, Chair, yes, I'll be missing my flight.
Yes.
Yeah, I would like to rush.
Okay.
Yeah, because we have left at 11. Thanks. Maybe just to indicate that the committee coordinator will then give them my contact number so that when they go for the arrangements for Monday, so that we can then communicate it.
Then you are released. Yes. Then the second item will be the briefing by the Department of the Defense with regard to the amendment to the International Hydrographic Organization. Without any waste of time, I'll give over to the Department of the Defense to firstly introduce themselves and immediately thereafter brief the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. As per the introduction, my name is Mamoloko Gugushi. I'm the Chief Defense Legal Services in the Department of Defense. I'm here on behalf of the Acting Secretary for Defense, Mr. Mutumi. With me, I have four members from the department, two from the Secretariat and two from the South African Navy. From the Secretariat, I've got Mr. McDooley, who is the Acting Director, Defense International Affairs. And I've also got Ms. Albert, who's the Assistant Director, Defense International Affairs. And from the South African Navy, I've got Rear Admiral Hicks, who is a flag officer, fleet in the Navy, and Captain Kempfer, who's the hydrographer. Thank you.
Thanks very much. You can continue the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. The presentation will be, we thought we should do it in two phases. First, we should try to explain to the committee what about the science of hydrography. And then we then take it to the legal technical process, that is the amendment of the protocol. The presentations will be made by the, on this. First, I'll ask Ms. Doolin to give a brief background, and then Captain Kempfer will then do a presentation on the science of the of hydrography, and then Rear Admiral Hicks will also assist him, and then thereafter, Mr. McDooling will then do the legal technical process. Thank you, Mr. McDooling.
Good morning, Honorable Chair. My name is Paul McDooling. Thank you, sir. As Ms. Kabushi said, I will first just do an overview of the scope of the presentation. First of all, we'll explain the aim, the historical perspective. And then from there on, Captain Kempfer will do the technicalities concerning the science of hydrography. And then I will very briefly explain the regulatory process as to why we're doing the tabling in Parliament of this protocol of amendments to the International Hydrographic Organization Convention. Attached to that is the physical protocol of amendments, which we've analyzed the different amendments to the protocol or of the protocol on the responsibilities of the Department of Defense as well as the South African government. And then I'll just explain the approval process or ratification process, and then thereafter we'll have to notify the International Hydrographic Organization and then the recommendations. The reason, or we have had two briefings to the Portfolio Committee on Defense, Mr. Chair, concerning this process. And this is the third briefing that we're having. So we, at this stage, do not know where the formal approval process in Parliament is. We have not been informed accordingly. But nonetheless, we will now proceed to do the presentation for you. The aim would be to inform members of the Select Committee on all the modalities of the protocol and then to make a recommendation to the members concerning the approval of the amendments. Next, please. So South Africa became a member of the a member state of the International Hydrographic Organization in 1967. It was ratified in Parliament in 1968. There are current membership of about 80 member states, which Captain Kempfer will elucidate on. The International Hydrographic Organization Convention is an intergovernmental, consultative, and technical organization that was established in 1921, as far back as 1921, to support the safety and navigation and the protection of the maritime environment. Now, South Africa, the Republic of South Africa, is presented by the International Hydrographic Organization, by the South African and Navy Hydrographer Captain Albert Kamsa sitting right in front of you, sir. Now, during the third extraordinary international hydrographic conference held in Monaco, on the 14th of April 2005, they've adopted a resolution to amend the preamble as well as 19 articles of the convention. Now, that is the 1967 version that you have in front of you. And the amendment was done in terms of in accordance with Article 21 thereof. Now, the objective there was to improve the scope, the objectives, the capacity and effect of the International Hydrographic Organization Convention. It was virtually just an update. Now, I'm going to ask Captain Confer now just to go to explain the technical modalities or the operational and technical modalities of South Africa's membership of the International Hydrographic Organization. Being the South African representative on the board, he's the expert in that particular area. So with your permission, then I'm handing over to you, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Captain Aubrey Kamsa, hydrographer of the South African Navy. Thank you for this opportunity to be here. It's indeed an honor. It's the first time I've been on this side of the parliament. Last time we were on the other side. But thank you, and I hope I'll be able to give you enough background on this issue. Just a quick summary of the presentation. I intend to give you a brief introduction to the International Hydrographic Organization, a very brief synopsis of the importance of hydrography, with respect to SOLAS, that's the Safety of Life at Sea Convention, it's the IMO Convention, very, very small status report on hydrography in Africa, and then the IHO Convention and the proposed amendments, very, very brief. Firstly, I thought, just to get us all on the same page, let's just give you a definition of hydrography. Hydrography is the branch of applied sciences which deals with the measurement and description of the physical features of the ocean, seas, coastal areas, lakes, and rivers, as well as with the prediction of their change over time, for the primary purpose of safety of navigation and in support of all other marine activities, including economic development, security and defense, scientific research, and environmental protection. So it's quite a mouthful, but I can assure you it's a very important art and a capability to have in the country. So the International Hydrographic Organization, as Mr. Mduli mentioned, it's an intergovernmental and consultative technical organization that was established in 1921, mainly to support the safety of navigation and the protection of the marine environment. Before that, everything was very haphazard, and every shipping company basically had their own charts, they did their own surveys and things like that. So this brought everybody together. Initially, the initial member states were about 19. I'm going to go briefly through the objectives of the IHO just to give you a better understanding of that. It is to promote the use of hydrography for the safety of navigation and all other marine purposes, to raise global awareness of the importance of hydrography. It's also there to improve global coverage, availability, and quality of hydrographic data, information, products, and services, and to facilitate access to such data, information, products, and services. And it's to improve the global hydrographic capability, capacity, training, science, and techniques. Furthermore, to establish and enhance the development of international standards for hydrographic data, information, products, services, techniques, and to achieve the greatest possible uniformity in the use of these standards. If you take a chart from one country and use one from another IHO member state country, it must look exactly the same. You do not want to confuse the mariners, otherwise it will not lead to safety of navigation. Further on, to give authoritative and timely guidance on all hydrographic matters to states and international organizations, to facilitate coordination of hydrographic activities among the member states, and enhance cooperation on hydrographic activities among states on a regional basis. Now, the current member states, as you can see there, we had 80 member states of the IHO, and you will notice that Africa is not that well represented.
something that the first question that people always ask, but why do we really have to do hydrography and what is behind all this? Who's going to force you to do hydrography? South Africa is a member of the International Maritime Organization. The Safety of Life at Sea Convention, SOLAS, is quite pertinent on the hydrographic responsibilities that contracting governments, and South Africa is a contracting government of IMO, and they have ratified the SOLAS convention. But it's in Chapter 5, Regulation 4, it states that each contracting government shall take all steps necessary to ensure that when intelligence of any dangers is received from whatever reliable source, it shall be promptly brought to the knowledge of those concerned and communicated to other interested governments. Now, the reason, the way that this is now being done, the whole world was basically divided in NAV areas. There's about 18 NAV areas. And South Africa is the NAV Area Coordinator, NAV Area Coordinator 7, as you can see there. It goes basically from the Angolan coast, Angolan border, the northern Angolan border, all the way down to Antarctica, and then on the eastern side of the coast to the north of Madagascar, basically the northern border of Mozambique. The responsibility of NAV Area Coordinator is in my office as the hydrographer. And it means that all information, exactly as the SOLAS agreement requires, any information that we get gets transmitted to the mariners as soon as we are there to ensure that there's no dangers that they are to the mariners, that they're aware of it. SOLAS goes on in Chapter 5, Regulation 9, that contracting governments undertake to arrange for the collection, the survey, and compilation of hydrographic data and the publication, dissemination, and keeping up to date of all nautical information necessary for safe navigation. So it's the surveying and the production of the nautical charts and publications that go with that. So let's continue. In particular, contracting governments undertake in a manner most suitable for the purpose of aiding navigation that to ensure that hydrographic surveys are carried out, to prepare and issue nautical charts, sailing directions, list of lights, tide tables, and other nautical publications, promulgate notices to mariners, and to provide data management arrangements to support these services. Okay. It goes on, contracting governments undertake to ensure the greatest uniformity in charts and nautical publications and to take into account, whenever possible, relevant international resolutions and recommendations. And they specifically refer here to the resolutions, recommendations adopted by the International Hydrographic Organization. Well, there's also very strong support for the IHO in the United Nations. According to the resolution, as you can see on the screen there, it states in 2003 that it welcomes the work of the IHO. It encouraged increased membership. It invites IHO and IMO efforts to accelerate transition to electronic charts and increase coverage of hydrographic information, and encourages intensified efforts to increase hydrographic capability in the least developed countries and small island states. Now, if you look at that slide, you can see the African International Maritime Organization member states. It is almost all the coastal states of Africa belongs to IMO. If you look at the African member states of the IHO, you will see that there's not that many member states. And that, unfortunately, even with all the recommendation of the United Nations, also leads that the African states do not comply with the IMO regulations as depicted in the SOLAS Convention. The IHO decided that they need to assist member states and non-member states to comply with the IMO SOLAS agreement or convention. And the world was again divided up into regional hydrographic commissions with particular emphasis on support to the non-IHO member states. As you can see, the regional hydrographic commission in our area, of the SADC area, is called SAIC, Southern African Islands Hydrographic Commission. the African area has basically been divided into four regional commissions, which you can see there. Southern Africa Islands Hydrographic Commission. The previous chairperson was Mozambique. I've just been elected again as chair. So South Africa is now the chair of SAIC, and you can see the member states are all ISO member states that have property in our area, which is France, Norway, Mozambique, South Africa, UK, and Mauritius, and then the other non-ISO member states as depicted there. Now, the responsibilities in our region, South Africa is also the charting coordinator for this whole area. Now, currently, we are responsible for charting of the South African waters, and we also do the charting on behalf of Namibia. We divided the area in areas of responsibility because of the neighboring countries that do not have the capability to conduct hydrographic surveys or charting. And it's been divided. Angola and Mozambique will be covered by Portugal. The UK cover the Tanzanian waters, and France cover the area around their coast. So in that sense, we basically assist the non-IHO member states to comply with their SOLAS agreement. Now, the IHO spends a lot of time to do capacity building in the region, and just the areas colored in there, all the states that have received capacity building, it's mainly in the form of technical visits, advice, training courses, etc. Now, just to recap on the convention of the International Hydrographic Organization, as was mentioned by Mr. Madoon, South Africa became a member of the IHO in 1951. The first IHO convention was ratified in 1986 by the South African Parliament. And then, of course, the convention, the protocol of amendments came up. And what's very important in the 4 years since the approval of the protocol of amendments, only 23 member states have indicated their approval of this protocol of amendments. They're there. It's Australia, Cuba, Cyprus, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, etc. In Africa, basically, it's only Tunisia and Morocco are the only African states that I can see that have ratified this convention so far. Now, if you look at the old structure, just to give a little bit of background why they decided to change the protocol of amendments came up, is the old structure basically they almost dates back to 1921, and it was very cumbersome, very difficult to make decisions. It really consists of the member states, which is the IHO body, a small the International Hydrographic Bureau, which is the secretariat, then you have the regional commissions, and then quite a lot of the working commissions that provides the work that goes to the conference where all the decisions can be made. But there's always felt that the IHO decision-making process was very cumbersome and very difficult to obtain any decisions to make the organization move forward, and therefore the changes to the present convention. As you can see in the proposed model, which is basically the whole cornerstone of this protocol of amendments, that the assembly will now become the main body. That's the proposal. The secretariat with the ISB will stay exactly the same. The difference is here that the council has been introduced, very similar to what they have at the International Maritime Organization, where the assembly will consist of all member states, all 80 of the member states, and more that will join later on, we hope. The council only exists of 30 people. And when we went through the process of designing this model, there was a lot of emphasis on the regional representation to make sure that all these regional commissions are strongly represented in this council, because that's really where a lot of the decision-making will now happen. All the working committees will basically divided under two main working committees, and as you can see, the regional commissions falling on under one single commission. As this convention has not been ratified, the proposed model cannot be introduced, but for ease of working in the organization, the model of the two main committees with the subcommittees under them has been adopted in the beginning of 2009, and that is what we currently work on. Now, South Africa, as South African Hydrographic Office, we represent South Africa in the majority of those working committees. And currently I am the vice chair of the IRCC, the Interregional Coordinating Committee, which is one of the, as I said, one of the main committees, and also I'm also the chairman of the Southern Africa Hydrographic Commission. So, just very in a nutshell, the implications. Well, to the IHO, of course, the approval of the Protocol of Amendments is an indispensable prerequisite for the modernization of the IHO, as I have explained. And we require, or the IHO requires, 31 more approvals before this Protocol of Amendments can come into effect. What's the implications on South Africa? The membership fees that we currently pay, which is based on the tonnage of the country, it's at 15,000 euros. That is remaining the same. It's not going to be increased. It has been at this level since 2002. Has not been increased since then. The only thing that will increase this, of course, is the exchange rate, because the membership fees are in euros. Or if we become successful and have more merchant vessels on our register, that will increase our tonnage, and then I will have to pay more membership fees. This membership fees comes out of the budget of the Hydrographic Office. Of course, I believe that if South Africa ratifies this convention, it will greatly enhance our international standing. South Africa is seen as the leading hydrographic office in Africa. We're the only African hydrographic office present at the majority of these working meetings. We are the only African nation that produces electronic navigation charts. So we are a leader in Africa, and I think this will send a very strong message that we take this very seriously. And of course, it will also allow us to continue to champion capacity building in the region. As the chairman of SAIC, I've always been the coordinator of the hydrographic capacity building register for the region. I've been extensively involved in capacity building technical visits into the region, into the SADC region. We are doing our bit. We're currently at my office. We're training a member of Mozambique Hydrographic Office in electronic chart production. We're having for 2 months, and it's our aim that at the end of this 2 months, he will go back home with Mozambique's first electronic navigational chart of the harbor of Maputo. So it's something that we're looking forward to achieve. We have trained hydrographic surveyors from many states in the region as well. So, sir, thanks for your attention. Sorry it was a bit long. I tried to do it as fast as I can, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Magdulin will do the final part.
I will be very brief on the next one, which is fairly just an explanation of the regulatory process that we followed. Why did we end up in Parliament? With the path that led to that. First of all, we approached the Defence Staff Council in November 2006 to approach Cabinet by means of a Cabinet memorandum to obtain a Cabinet mandate to approach Parliament. And then we've done intra-departmental consultations in terms of our own internal processes on that side to get as wide as possible consultations and inputs from all the services in the department as well as other divisions. And then we embarked on inter-departmental consultations. We've consulted with the Department of Transport, amongst others, the Justice and Constitution Development. We even consulted SAMHSA, the South African Maritime Safety Authority. And then obviously, as prescribed, the Chief State Law Advisor, International Law and Foreign Affairs at that stage, the new DECO. And then we went past the RPS clusters in February 2007, who recommended that we should table it in Parliament, in Cabinet. Cabinet gave us a positive mandate to approach Parliament in May 2007. We've managed to get it on the roll on the 18th of November this year, hence the two briefings that we've had to the Portfolio Committee. Now, the regulatory process, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, it prescribes that if we do sign an international convention like the International Hydrographic Convention that binds the Republic of South Africa as a member state only after it's been approved by resolution in both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces, unless it's a technical administrative or executive agreement, which this is not. And what is very important here, Mr. Chair, is that amendments to such international agreements are dealt with in the same manner. In other words, we also have to table it for a resolution in the National Assembly as well as the National Council of Provinces, which we, in fact, have done at this stage, and we're busy with the due diligence process. Now, the Protocol of Amendments, it was attached as Annexure B. We've explained extensively, we've analyzed everything, and we've explained it extensively in the memorandum, which is open. I'm not sure whether you would like, Mr. Chair, for us to go through that in detail. It's very legal, technical. What I'll do is I'll give a synopsis of the implications of the amendment, so if that is okay with you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Captain Comfer already explained the positive a benefit for South Africa as also for the region, being first of all a member of the International Hydrographic Organization, as well as the aim and the purpose or the objectives of the amendments to the convention. I'm not going to go into that. I just want to summarize here that it will have no negative impact on the rights and responsibilities of the Republic as a member state. And that the proposed amendments will improve the scope, the objective, the capacity and effect of the convention, as he's explained. It was virtually time for an update of the convention, which they've done, and to comply with international requirements in the maritime environment, so it was necessary to amend the convention. Now, he explained our membership. And as you said, it will have no additional financial implications. I just want to add that if the captain are now eligible, you will be eligible to be selected on some of the new bodies as a South African hydrographer. So that might imply small amounts of money, additional amounts of money, if you have to travel to a particular convention meeting or a subcommittee meeting, whatever the case might be. So it's not, it does not entail a major financial implications for the government at this stage through the South African Department of Defense and through its office in future. So now, just the constitutional implications for South Africa, sir, is that what is very important here, the Protocol of Amendments contains no self-executing provisions in terms of Section 2314 of the Constitution. Now, that means that if we do adopt the Protocol of Amendments without reservation, sir, then if it does contain the self-executing provisions, it would mean that it forms part of the South African law. It becomes law in South Africa. Now, this convention does not contain that. We will have to go and enact it later on if necessary. But it's very important that we just want to make this clear that it will not become part of the South African law because of the fact that it does not contain self. And that opinion was given by two chief state law advisors at Justice and Constitutional Development and the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. Now, and the security implications, the provision of hydrographic services through the continued membership of the International Hydrographic Organization as a strategic resource to both the RSA government as well as to other SADCA governments could contribute substantially towards the enhancement of regional maritime security in particular and to regional security in the broader context. Now, I'm going to say, with your permission and Ms. Kabush's permission, just ask the Admiral to elucidate on the strategic importance of our membership of the International Hydrographic Organization. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Honourable Chair. I'm Rear Admiral Higgs-Clegg of the Fleet. Just to reiterate, sir, I think that you've got a very good idea of what hydrography is and what it means for South Africa's standing in the international community. But just at the fleet level, being down a little bit lower, hydrography allows us to use the sea, sir. 55% of the GDP of this nation is based on maritime trade, and it is estimated that between 90 and 95% of our imports and exports go by sea, and hydrography is the key to that. With regard to what the Navy is doing at the moment concerning hydrography, you've seen the hydrographer in action here. Our hydrographic vessel, the SS Protea, sailed yesterday with 100 South Africans on board. She's currently en route to Durban, where she's going to spend the next month at sea, involved in surveying activities. And in a nutshell, that touches on why this is so important to South Africa, particularly with regard to our economy and particularly with regard to our broad maritime responsibilities to ourselves and to the broader global economy. That is all I have to say, just to add a little bit of context from the fleet side, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sir, that is our presentation.
Thanks very much. Thanks once again for the presentation. Our role as the select committee is to exercise oversight over the departments. And as you can see, most members of the committee are not around. But when I went through the documents, it aroused some interest. I have decided that when other members are around, we will request to interact once again with you and maybe undertake some visits to your office and see you in action. That will expose us deeply into your activities, and we'll have a clear understanding on how you operate. We will occasionally communicate with your office in due course and arrange when we will be ready to undertake such visit. I don't know whether honorable member have some questions to ask, but before I hand over to him, when you explained that one of your objectives is mainly to do with the prediction of change in the sea and advise some states, there has been in the past some disasters. The recent one in Samoa in Philippines. Do you know exactly the impact of such disasters before they occur? And how do you maybe, in where you possibly can, assist in preventing some of them to occur? And in the capacity building, especially in other African countries, where you have indicated that other countries are not members, what do you do to encourage them to see the necessity and the importance of being members? And I think that that will be the two questions that we will have, and then I'll hand over to the commissioner.
Thanks. We've been with how many? Nearly 20 questions. Campfire is definitely the unwork. Okay. It was mentioned that African states are not well represented. What could be the reason thereof? This is one of the questions. What is the requirement to become a member? Sometimes it will encourage them. Or is there anything which they're supposed to have in order to to qualify. I saw on the slide there, unfortunately it was written that some member states have been suspended, others pending. What was the reason? And then I'm happy that now you, Captain Kefa or General Kefa is one of the vice chairpersons. But you mentioned that in some of the committees, you are a chairperson. We are definitely happy and appreciate to have one member in our country to be a vice chairperson, because we will know that we are well represented. Won't it be necessary sometimes that the Minister of Interwater Relations to be briefed about this thing, so that whenever she visits some of the councils, we'll be able to expand by saying that, no, in our relationship with this country, then we're having 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think it would be proper that the Minister of Internal Relations, yes, to be briefed about this, and then she must be part and parcel of this, so that it will give yourself that oomph. The conferences, you know, while in the police, I organized the International Crime Prevention Collegium, and I pressed to the member state that to hold our meeting in South Africa. That thing benefits. People in this country will be able to know that, we are represented. We are also a member country in that type of hydro what? I saw one thing that member states said they meet every, or the councils meet every 3 years. That 25% of member states, the abbreviation of MIN, I didn't know. Will you please explain more about that thing? When you answer, you will go through. The Mozambique training. What medium of instruction of police? Is it Portuguese, or are you training them in English? Such type of. Scope and objective. Yeah, no, the other one, two of them has been answered by the gentleman there. I wanted to ask about the issue of the security implication. How do you share using that C, the economy? No, has been answered. Yeah, thanks.
Maybe before you respond, Captain, with regard to training, how many South Africans are you training, maybe to become a hydrographer after you have left? Especially maybe amongst blacks, women, and people with disability.
Thank you, sir. We, as part of the Navy, we definitely have a training program and a succession planning process as well. With respect to hydrographic surveyors, it's a little bit more difficult because it's a very scarce skill, and there's quite a demand for surveyors, especially in the oil industry. A lot of our South African surveyors are now working outside. So it is definitely a problem to try and keep enough people, so we can never train enough. But we do have a succession plan. We currently have all races represented on the SS Protea as surveyors, and women. So we definitely, that's definitely something that we look at. With regards to people with disabilities, We do our work at sea. We're all combat officers, so we do all the qualification courses. You have to navigate a ship, so you have to be medically fit to serve at sea. I do have, however, one of my instructors at my office is blind in one eye, and so he can't go to sea anymore. So he does have a disability. But, I mean, he's got a lot of knowledge, and we still have a space for him, and he can impart that knowledge on. So I hope I've answered the question. We definitely have a program, we have a succession plan, but it takes quite a large number of years to train a surveyor. We're a small branch of the Navy, and if you lose one person, you actually lose a lot of years. So that is difficult. It is a challenge, and we're well aware of that, and we're trying to address it. But again, the scarce skills, unfortunately, is also an issue with us. I'm going to try and answer all those questions, and if I miss some of them, please remind me. I'll start with the tsunamis. We belong to the Global Observation Network. We have a series of tide gauges all around our coast, which is monitored from my office. We do it 24 hours real time. We can download the tidal data as we sit here. It's been downloaded. So we have 10 tide gauges all around the coast, so we monitor the tides all the time. We produce tide tables. So if you're a keen fisherman, I'm sure you must have used some of my products to know when it's high tide or when it's nice spring tide and things like that. So we produce that. To predict a tsunami, because we belong to this global network, when there's an earthquake like we've had now in the Sumatra fault that creates these tsunamis, there's normally an alarm that goes up. And that's where this navigational warning network also comes in. We get informed, and then we will transmit a warning signal on that. And it's more a coastal warning because ships at sea, the tsunami wave has no effect on ships at sea. That wave only picks up when it comes in close to the shore, and when there's a very shoaling of the seafloor where it becomes shallow, and then the wave builds up. So it's more a warning for ships in harbor and for coastal areas. But we do issue those warnings. So we monitor that. You must remind me of, you had two others, sorry. If you can just remind me on the next one.
Their impact, whether you can be able to prevent their effect.
Yes, the prevention of with the data that we have available, we've got the National Archive of Hydrographic Information as well. And that is available, of course, to all government departments. It's used for extensively for coastal planning because they can build models from this bathymetry that we have gathered over the years to predict the effects of such a tsunami wave. So coastal planning basically can be done such to limit the damage of such a wave. I mean, you can't really stop the wave because it's a natural phenomena, but you can do proper planning, which years ago probably didn't happen. People tried to be as close to the beach as possible. The raising of the sea levels is in the news all the time, but we keep on monitoring all those kind of issues. The last big tsunami that we had in, I think it was in 2006, we actually picked it up on our tide gauges at the time of the eruption. You could pick up the interference on our gauges. So, yes, we do monitor that. I'll try, and if I miss out something, as I remember things, I'm going along. Unfortunately, I didn't have a pen here with me. Yes, going back to the reason why African states are not represented. Within the regional commission, that was really one of the main purposes that the IHO set up the regional commissions, to pull in the non-member states, to educate them, to tell them about the importance of hydrography, and at the same time also to get awareness of the shortcomings and where we can assist as the member states. And that's why we've done a lot of the capacity building efforts is really aimed at those non-member states. So the money that we use for capacity building comes from the IHO member states. We've just had the recent SAIC meeting in Reunion, where we've had very good representation from all the countries in our region. And we also had a seminar for the heads of the delegations where we paid specific emphasis on the importance of hydrography, how to set up an offices. The reason why states don't belong to it, I think it is more that not all states are aware of the importance of the sea, what you can gain out of that, and it's really it's an economic decision to make a decision to set up a department, to give them the mandate, to give them the money to do that. If you weigh that against the gains out of it, it's actually quite an easy sum to make. And when we've done our, when we did our technical visits in the various countries, we went right up to the ministers of those countries, Minister of Transport, and explained to them the importance of hydrography, the economic importance of it. Because if your harbor is not properly surveyed, if you do not have up-to-date navigational chart of that harbor, a reputable shipping company will not come into your harbor. Those guys that do come in will charge you a lot more for the products that they have to deliver because they've got an enormous insurance fee that they have to pay. And those kind of things, I mean, you would think that people can see the light that, yes, we need to establish something like that. It is very expensive. The South African Hydrographic Service started in 1922. We're actually the oldest branch of the Navy. Not everybody in the Navy always want to hear that, but we're the oldest branch of the Navy. And so it's a lot of experience, a lot of historic data that we have assembled in our archives. For Namibia to start up their own hydrographic service will take many, many years, also a lot of money. But they've got a really pragmatic arrangement with us. We do the services on their behalf, so they comply with the IMO SOLAS agreement. So can any other country go into an agreement with a next-door neighbor that has an hydrographic capability to do such work? And that is something that we also encourage. We've got a generic bilateral arrangement which I've distributed through all these member states or non-member states where they can basically go into an agreement for somebody to do it on their behalf. If you look at the question on the proposed model, the 25% of the member states, you obviously used to big assemblies. People don't make the decision really when you sit with our assembly is the size of about sometimes up to 350, 400 people. Decisions is very difficult to make in such a big audience. So it's good to come with resolutions and people have basically the plan has been made for them and it's easy to make decisions. And that is the whole idea with the council, to minimum the size to 25% of member states, and there's a whole formula of working out the representativity of that. But normally the chairman of the regional commissions, they will all serve on the council. So in our case, if this gets ratified and the council comes into place, South Africa will be represented at the council, which is the second most important part of the organization. And therefore, the size of it was limited to 30 people. As the organization grows, we're currently at 80. They'll have to maybe revisit that, but the whole idea was to try and keep it as small as possible. It is, of course, open to all member states. Everybody can come in there, but the council itself is 30 people. And from my experience in the other main working committees of the IHO, it is very rare that you have more than 30 nations represented at any meeting. So it was almost the ideal figure that they selected. So the active members of the organization is not all that. And the whole purpose of this structure is really to rectify that, to make it better. You said it's, you mentioned also, sir, that to have these meetings in your own country. South Africa, the Hydrographic Service has played host to a number of these IHO meetings, and for your information, I'm the host of the Hydrographic Commission on Antarctica meeting that's going to happen in Simonstown. It starts on Monday, where South Africa, of course, is a member of the Antarctic Commission, Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, serves on on that committee as well. We've got a presence, a research station in Antarctica, so we are considered also as a main role player there. So it's an international meeting that we're hosting in Simonstown for 3 days. We've hosted some others before. Basically, every year we normally try and host one of these meetings ourselves. So we do advertise the country, and I can assure you that everybody that has been to one of our meetings always come back and say they would like to come back as a tourist. So hopefully we do something for the tourism of the country as well, but this is really a working committee, and there's a full agenda. It's normally 3 days of serious work. I hope I've covered some of them. The other one was the suspended. That one, sir. Yeah. Okay. It's the member states, the nice green ones. Suspended, that is the Democratic Republic of Congo. We all know that the internal situation in that country was not good for many, many years, so not really a government in place. So the reason when you get suspended is when you do not pay your membership fees. So they still suspended. Pending are those countries that have applied for membership. And it's not a big process to become a member of the IHO. Basically, you have to apply. There's an easy process to do. And then the pending bit is one of the challenges that we have in the IHO of decision making, because all member states have to decide if this country can be accepted in the organization, and you need to, like the same for this ratification of the amendment, you need to get about a two-thirds members that must agree. And it's not that people don't want other countries to join the organization. It's sometimes just a process of decision-making, and that is the reason, one of the main reasons why we're trying to change the structure. We can accelerate these kind of decisions. So pending, it's really they're waiting to get the required amount of votes, and then they get incorporated into the organization. For the organization, the more members we have, the better, because then we'll reduce the membership fees, and or if they stay the same, we have more money available to use for capacity building.
What is your interaction or influence with the countries who are non-members, but there are, say, illegal activities that happen along their coastlines, like the piracy along Somalia, where ships are illegally taken. How do you intervene in such circumstances?
Thank you, sir. Hydrography is almost a humanitarian, peaceful occupation. Although I'm a warfare officer, my profession, we don't make war. So I think I must ask Admiral Hicks to just answer that question, because then we go into maritime security, which is not my domain.
Honorable Chair, sir, just with regard to the communication between nations, there's the broad maritime community which allows that type of communication, but with regard to specific security issues, it depends on whether you have a bilateral or some multilateral agreements with things. We have a specific group of SADC, which refers to a Standing Maritime Committee as part of the ISDSC, which meets on a regular basis, but that is SADC-related. And as a result of that, we had our recent Golfino exercise, where the South African Navy exercised with Angola and Namibia for the first time ever and came back. But talking specifically to Somalia, we do not have a formal direct relationship to interface with regard to the piracy issues. The issues with regard to piracy, though, are very, very visible to us. They're visible to us, particularly on the intelligence side. At the policy side, it's hotly debated, etc. But as the South African Navy prepares maritime forces, primarily our frigates and our submarines at this stage, and we deploy our forces wherever we have to, as determined by the elected civil authorities, the commander-in-chief. So just to sum up, there's no specific linkage in with ourselves and the security people of Somalia at this stage, but should the government wish to do so, we could obviously turn on something in that regard.
I'd just like to add, concerning the sharing of information and the suggestion by the honourable member in terms of the process through Department of International Relations and Cooperation, and the minister playing a role to inform other Africa states as well. We have joint permanent commissions on defence and security with Botswana, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Angola, and Namibia, which is a multi-departmental engagement on an annual basis, led by the Department of Defense, and including safety and security, GECO, justice, and several other governmental departments. And then we have bilateral defense committees, which is a slightly lower the type of meeting with Nigeria, Tanzania, Egypt, Algeria, the DRC, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Lesotho, which also meets on a regular basis, some of them on an annual basis, some of them on a biannual basis. And then we also share information concerning, and just to link what the Admiral said here, in terms of maritime security as well as regional security and continental security with other countries, European countries and other non-European countries, Asian countries, with which we have formal relationships, defense relationships, like European countries, Scandinavian countries, Eastern countries, where we share information concerning, they're also using the same maritime routes concerning these issues. So, and it's formalized by means of international agreements to share this information. So there's ample opportunity to share information concerning wide areas of defense-related matters, including hydrography. We do share that, and it's subject to agreement between the two entities, between South Africa and Namibia, to share that. So it's open. It's not limited. We can share any aspect of our defense relationship concerning a wide range of issues. And we do make use of that. Other state departments do also share information concerning that.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Thank you for the explanation there, but the issue which I wanted to say, just to get the minister of that involvement of that, together to get that to be involved, and that's it. Then it is different to share information. If she becomes involved, more especially if you know, when you approach this type of it's my advice, this type of briefing, because of the security fear, something of the sort, you start as that what is your rank again?
Admiral.
You know, when he came, you could see the picture of our country, the usage of the sea, the economy, security implication. He came so short, but gives the whole picture out. But if you start scientifically, as you started, when you come there, people say, you know, they don't understand. It's so scientific. But when you start there, just pushing your security, the usage, the economy, more especially now the economy is on a downtrend. They'll become so involved. They say, oh, this is the part which is going to help South Africa. You know? Just the Ghanaian Africa, the prickle, what I even said. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. This was a very informative engagement, and as I have said, we will make a follow-up to another interaction in due course. And we hope that each time we request you to come before the committee, you will always be available. Thank you very much, Megugushe, May Albert, Captain Kamfa, Tate Magduli, and the Admiral Hicks. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I had the last one here, but it was a follow-up to Captain Kamfa, where he answered your question and saying that we need a physical ability. You put that note. Yeah, physical fit is what he said. He said we need a physical fit person. He was answered in the issue of disabled. I want to put this question. You know that gentleman who's doing sprint in South Africa, having a lot of medals. If somebody didn't sit down and come up with this iron of sprinting, definitely will be useless. Now I'm making a call to this unit to sit down and say, okay, to the disability, even if physically he's somewhere, but if the head and the brain is okay, he can sit on the computer there, pushing the chair, sitting there, but coming up with a brilliant idea. In one of the Bible, I learned somebody was, he said the country in somewhere in Nineveh. He was an ordinary person, but because of his brain, he helped the country. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for my response. Thank you very much for those inputs. When I responded to the question, I specifically spoke about surveys. But hydrography is not only hydrographic surveying, it's also the cartography. The people that create the charts that ships use for navigation. Nowadays, everything is being done on computers. So somebody that is in a wheelchair can become a cartographer and can be utilized with it very, very easily. So we need people with the brains, and I will take as many brains I can get. So if you have a couple that you can pass on, Commissioner, I'll be very happy. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the meeting. Okay.
Well, now I would rather end right to, even his voice, it shows that he's not zero.
I actually don't know it.
Thank you.
Thank you.